Coming up today, Facebook blocks ad blockers, why crows are even craftier than we thought, and we sit down with Reed Hastings, CEO and founder of Netflix, to talk about taking on Facebook, ignoring VR, and sex memes. You're listening to episode 280 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hello.
And podcast newcomer, Amelia Heathman.
Hi.
Amelia, this is your first week at Wired.
Yes.
Have we treated you well?
I think so. I'm just about surviving.
You're settling in well.
Yes.
Matt, I want to talk to you about Wired Security. It's our new one-day event that will explore, explain, and predict new trends, threats, and defences in cybersecurity. That's our marketing blurb. But tell us why people really should be there.
So on October the 20th at Level 39 in Canary Wharf, London, we've got a bunch of interesting people and startups coming along to talk to us about cybersecurity. So this is everything from chief information officers at the Estonian government, people from big security companies, and also people, security researchers, independent people who are looking at big issues that are affecting us in terms of the stuff we use on computers every day, business systems, and everything in between, really.
And you're helping to put together the startup stage, which is where we're getting companies that probably no one's heard of yet that are going to be doing really, really exciting things that we think people need to know about. And that's always a really interesting part of our events, is these big names on the main stage. But then the startup stage can often be where some really amazing companies are put in front of the public, kind of in front of people for the first time.
Yeah, and some of the people that we're looking at bringing to the event this year are loads of people looking at AI, threat detection and insecurity, basically ways to protect business systems and how to actually make our products and devices better. And these are all sort of people who are a little bit under the radar at the moment, that a lot of people wouldn't have heard of, and actually who are going to probably, and hopefully, fingers crossed, be big in the next few years.
So it ain't just antivirus companies and ad blockers and things like that. Promises to be a really, really fascinating day. If you're interested, head to wiredevent.co.uk. All right, a thing you learnt this week, Matt Burgess.
This week I've learned that King's Cross, one of London's biggest train stations, only had two platforms when it was first built in the 1800s. One for trains arriving and one for trains leaving.
Just kind of cute.
Yeah.
Now it has a platform zero.
Yeah, and a 9¾.
Yeah, kind of. But no trains leave from that, apart from in your dreams. Amelia, what did you learn this week?
I learned a really exciting fact about volcanoes. So one of Nicaragua's most active volcanoes, which is also called the Mouth of Hell, is going to have Wi-Fi sensors placed in it, so the sensors can send alerts for when an eruption is going to happen. So
there is no limit to where someone will put a Wi-Fi sensor. So it's an internet-connected volcano. But this is actually quite a clever idea, right?
Yeah, it's really exciting because the last volcano eruption was in 2008, and obviously loads of lives get put at risk whenever an eruption happens, obviously. So they're going to do this, test it out in this volcano, and then they want to connect all volcanoes so that then they know when an eruption is going to happen next, which is really exciting.
And just a few minutes of extra warning when a volcano is about to erupt can mean that an awful lot of people's lives are saved. I learned this week, this is kind of a difficult one to explain, but according to new research from the Max Planck Institute, facial recognition software can even see through blurred images. So you'll often see in a newspaper, for example, an image will be blurred to remove people that aren't suspects in a case or something like this. But it turns out that an AI system only needs 10 fully visible examples of a person's face to then see through that blurring. And if you give it 10 examples, it can do it with an accuracy of 91.5%. And obviously, the less examples it gets, the less accurate it gets. And the researchers said that the only really effective way to stop people from being identified in blurred pictures is to just put a big black box in front of their face.
So, or wear a balaclava.
Or wear a balaclava, yeah. Although maybe that wouldn't work if they were, I don't know.
If your eyes are on show, it probably wouldn't work.
Yeah, I guess if it can see anything
iris
of you.
Scanning technology.
Well, you can tell us all about it at Wired Security. Aha, segue. All right, our first story this week is one that I've been looking at, Facebook and ad blockers. If you use an ad blocker and you use Facebook, you're about to start seeing ads again. Before we get into this, do either of you use an ad blocker?
Ad blockers are my life.
I've used one in the past, but I've strayed away from it now.
Amelia, I would like to point out that you work for a media organisation now that relies on advertising for its income.
I know. My ad blocker is turned off for Wired. It makes you the first time you go on it in order to see the rest of the content.
I am supporting
Wired.
Well, that's good to hear. Why did you turn it on in the first place?
For watching streaming shows on the internet.
So for YouTube and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then if I want to watch an American show that isn't on Netflix or available in the UK, we'll maybe find it. And the ads are just so annoying and junk up your computer and force you to quit applications that you don't want to quit.
Yeah, so it's because ads are bad.
Yes.
And even on good websites, ads are bad.
Yeah.
Basically. So this is what Facebook's trying to get around. So Facebook has found a way to block ad blockers. And we've seen an awful lot of media organizations start to do this. They flash up the message saying, oh, you're using an ad blocker. Yeah. Well, you can't read our site anymore. So it's going to start serving adverts to all users. The social network's decision to overpower ad blocking will see all desktop users, even those with ad blockers installed, presented with advertising for the first time. And you might think that's bad news because, as we said, people use ad blockers because they don't like ads, because ads are rubbish. Facebook's answer to that is that it's listened to feedback from users and it thinks that it understands that people use ad blockers because they're the best option to date. Its alternative option is allegedly to make advertising better, which is a bit of a risk.
It's a bit tricky to try and do that as well. And I know recently they were actually trialing adverts on their live streaming videos. So they were trialing short 15-second adverts in between like somebody's live broadcast.
That's annoying, though. If you're wanting to watch a live broadcast and you tune in exactly when it is live, getting an advert in the way is just irritating.
You might miss the best bit with a 30-second pre-roll about biscuits,
exactly,
which would be devastating. So Facebook's option is that if you don't like certain types of adverts, you can tell it that you don't like them and get rid of them. So if you're not interested in singles in your area or getting rock-hard abs or whatever else it is that flashes up on the internet these days, you can remove these interests from your ad preferences. So Facebook, like Google and Microsoft and all these other big, big internet companies, put together a profile of you based on what you search, what you click on, what you do, what you read, and they try and work out who you are. And if they're getting it wrong, then you can tell them, which is, it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? It's good for you, because I guess it means that you don't tend to see ads that are completely irrelevant, but it's brilliant for Facebook because it then means that they know absolutely without a shadow of a doubt exactly who you are and what you're interested in, which makes you hugely more valuable. Because if an advertiser wants to know that Amelia Heathman likes watching this American television show, they can advertise at you to tell you that it's now available on Amazon Prime Instant Video, not Netflix, and then you sign up to an Amazon account, bingo, new customer.
Yeah, I find it creepy though. For instance, if you are looking at a pair of trainers on Office and then 5 minutes later you go on Facebook and the ad for those trainers flashes up, it does weird you out a bit about the internet, all the information it has about you.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any sense that Facebook's going to stop tracking people across the internet to show them more relevant ads based on stuff that they've searched on, because they would argue that relevant ads are good ads. And Facebook isn't really alone. So in recent months, Forbes, Bloomberg, The Washington Post, City AM, our colleagues in America at Wired.com have started either blocking ad blockers or popping up messages saying, turn them off. That isn't a particularly good idea.
And this is all about money, really, isn't it? And when we cut down to it, the bottom line is the important thing here.
The bottom line is the bottom line, as it turns out. Yeah, so for Facebook, the gains could be absolutely massive. The social network generated $3.69 billion in profit on revenues of $17.93 billion in 2015. But here's the really interesting bit. In the first quarter of 2016 alone, Facebook's advertising revenue was up 57% to $5.2 billion. That was up from $3.3 billion for the same period in 2015. And mobile ads, which can't easily be blocked, so they're much more valuable, accounted for around 4/5 of that quarter one 2016 revenue. So if Facebook can crack the nut of desktop advertising, and it really can dodge ad blockers, this is going to be a massive gain for them and the amount of adverts that people are seeing. Because at the moment, I'll admit it, I use an ad blocker on Facebook because the ads are crappy.
I think one of the big things here is, though, you can't really... We're not paying for Facebook. We are, with the customers, you're not paying for it, which means you are effectively...
You're the product. You're being monetized.
Yeah, so would either of you two pay for Facebook if it was a completely ad-free version of it?
I think that would be the excuse I would need to get off Facebook. So if they started charging for it, I'd be out of there in a second.
I was speaking, I was on a panel at a socially responsible business talk, which might sound dull, but it isn't dull. And someone on the panel there said, well, hey, the only reason that Facebook exists is because of its users. And the only reason that Facebook's able to make money is because of its users. So quite a progressive thing to do would be to make all of Facebook's users shareholders in Facebook.
Oh.
So as a Facebook user, they're making money from you and you get that money back. So it becomes a social enterprise.
That's not really how businesses work, though. If they want to keep making money.
I don't think
they would make money, but you'd make the money with them. So it democratizes where the capital goes.
Well, it's an option. I don't think it's going to be one that happens looking at their recent revenues. But
No, probably not. They're doing quite well at the whole money-making thing. So we'll see how well this ad blocker adventure goes. And keep you updated. Amelia, your first story on the Wired podcast is all about crafty crows. Tell us some more.
Yes, I'm really loving this story. I think it's really amusing. So we found out that crows this week can make tools from twigs to get food. And biologists are really excited about the effect that this is going to have on research into animal intelligence.
So why is it so interesting that we already know crows are really, really clever?
Yeah.
But why is this particular piece of research so interesting?
So this all goes back to 2002 when a captive New Caledonian crow called Betty impressed scientists from Oxford by bending a piece of wire to form a hook in order to retrieve food from a tube. So everyone at the time thought Betty was the most intelligent crow that had ever existed because she'd exhibited these like advanced problem-solving skills that had never been seen before in an animal. And she was the only crow that seems to have been involved in this study. So she's the one whose legacy has lived on, despite the fact she died in 2005.
And it was presumed that she was exceptional.
Yeah.
But it turns out that she's not.
This is the sad thing. So new researchers at the University of St. Andrews have done a study with New Caledonian crows. So same breed as Betty. And basically, this has proven that the craftiness of the crows doesn't come from taking a problem and analysing it and working out solution, which was previously thought, but actually just the natural skills they learn in the wild. So they were given some tools and some plant material to make the tools with, and they hid their food in wooden logs, and then the crows then took the twigs, made them into a tool, and then got the food out of the logs in different ways.
So what it was thought that the only reason that they were able to do this is because they were presented with a piece of wire,
yeah,
which is quite an easy tool, but they're actually able to use, they're able to work out what twigs might be useful or
yeah,
what stones might be useful and use those tools and fashion those tools.
Yeah, so they did it in all different, the crows that were involved used it, used the tools in different ways. So some wedged them like into the holes to pull the food out that way, and some push the tools against the logs to kind of flex them and do it so in order to get the food from that way. But so at first, yeah, they were really impressed with this like dexterous behavior from the crows, but it just means that Betty isn't as clever as they thought because the other crows did the exact same thing. So clearly it's just a thing that crows can do in the wild, and this is kind of proving that.
And this builds on a huge body of evidence, a growing body of evidence, that crows are really bleeding clever.
Yeah.
And we've been reporting on the intelligence of crows for a number of years.
Yeah.
Wired UK. And there was an experiment between a baby and a crow a few years ago now.
Yeah.
What did that find?
So this actually proves that crows kind of aren't that clever because the two-year-old babies did better in this study than the crows did, which isn't really great on the crow's behalf. So scientists set up a experiment in order to see like how a crow would react to getting food in different ways. So in this experiment, there was a block above a rotating cylinder. And if the block fell on the cylinder, then food would become available. So first off, the block had meat on it. And if the crow tried to grab the meat, the block would fall and some more meat would become available as a reward. But then there was an unbaited block placed on the cylinder. The crows had to pick it up, drop it on the cylinder, and the meat would appear. But the crows couldn't work out how to do this, despite having seen it happen earlier. However, the group of two-year-olds realised that they could pick up the unbaited block and drop it on the cylinder to get a prize. But they weren't getting food, they were getting marbles instead.
So crows aren't as clever as a two-year-old, but they're still pretty clever for an animal. And there's been quite a few stories that we've written down the years about surprising findings about their intelligence. A year or so ago, we found out that ravens have, as we put it, paranoid abstract thoughts about other minds. So essentially, they could imagine being spied upon, and it was thought that only humans could imagine themselves being spied upon. And it means that the ravens behaved differently when they were doing something that they knew another raven might be interested in. Yeah. And that particularly relates to food, right?
So hiding food was considered extremely important to the ravens. And they would behave differently if they felt that they were being watched. So they would hide the food more quickly, or they wouldn't return to the hiding place if they thought a predator was around. And this study was kind of found out by the ravens guarding pockets of food and then near a peephole, and then sounds were played of other birds. So if the raven thought another bird was there, then they would hide their food more quickly. But then when the peephole was closed and they couldn't get access to hiding the food and there were still sounds, they didn't actually matter, which was kind of interesting. But
massive respect to the ravens and to the crows. And I'm sure there'll be lots more studies coming out as we... It's kind of a different way of understanding intelligence, right? They don't look human. They don't behave like a human, but they're doing things that are extremely, extremely intelligent.
Yeah.
Matt Burgess, our third story this week is about BBC iPlayer and the license fee. Before you get into the specifics, we've got a lot of readers from all around the world. They probably know what the BBC is, but what's the license fee?
So the BBC is... in part, and a lot of it, funded by the license fee, which is a collection of money, basically, I assume you can call it a tax. If people watch a BBC, consume its content, then you effectively have to pay £145.50 per year. And this goes back into programme making, into production, into paying staff wages, into the overall funding and running of the BBC.
And at present, that license fee only applies if you're watching BBC content live on a TV or anything else that's plugged in to the mains. Radio, you don't have to pay a license fee for. But technology has come a long way since the license fee rules were written up probably decades ago. And now it's being changed to incorporate iPlayer.
So from September the 1st, the license fee is changing for those people who are using the iPlayer, which is a catch-up and live service to watch content. So at the moment, if you're watching a live stream on the iPlayer, you're supposed to have a license fee and be paying this fee on a yearly basis. But if you're just watching catch-up TV, so programmes that have already been on, things that you're just watching, you can download them, watch them on the tube, watch them on your commute, watch them while you're doing something else, you don't have to pay the license fee.
So if it's not live, you don't have to pay?
Yeah. So anything that's already basically is a catch-up service, then you don't have to pay. And the change was first actually suggested in the government's review of the BBC earlier this year, which we talked about on the podcast. And it's actually already been brought into place. So from September the 1st, this is going to actually change because people are consuming the BBC and its content in a different way. And basically, as the lawmakers have decided that as we go on, there is going to be more people watching catch-up TV and watching iPlayer and everything on live services as they go. So we should be paying for this as well.
Seems fair.
I think it is.
Seems a very sensible decision. But there's been some unnecessary scare stories during the rounds in the mainstream press that kind of need debunking.
So this week and over the weekend, there's actually a story about saying that the BBC is going to have a new TV license detector van that is going to monitor people's private Wi-Fi networks to see what they're watching and if they're watching iPlayer without a license. So again, for people who aren't in the UK, there are these things called TV license detectors. There are people that are paid to go around and see if people are paying for a TV license. If they're not, they can take them to court to prosecute them. And as part of this, there are vans that supposedly go around around the UK and detect if people are watching iPlayer without having paid for a license.
Yeah, so these vans currently exist for TV broadcasts, so they're able to work out where people are getting TV signals into their house and watching stuff, and then they'll slip a letter through your door saying, "We believe you're watching TV, you don't have a license. Prove to us that you weren't watching TV," and then you can end up being fined and taken to court, etc., etc. So the theory was that this would be expanded because now they have to detect people watching iPlayer, and that requires a whole different toolkit of technology. But it's not, it's a bit, the story's dodgy.
So the Telegraph story, which was reporting this, said that the BBC, these new vans that they are supposedly actually working on, which will be operated by a contractor, Capita, which actually do the rest of their vans at the moment, would use a packet analysis to log traffic being passed between Wi-Fi networks. And the technique is basically a computer program or piece of computer hardware that can intercept and log traffic that is passing across a Wi-Fi network.
It's a sniffer, colloquially.
Yeah, colloquially it's called a wireless sniffer. So data passes across Wi-Fi networks in packets. The sniffer will capture each of the packet and in theory be able to decode what's in the packet, the raw data behind it, and show the value and different fields of what's contained in that data. And from this, you effectively be able to see what is being watched. Or
so in layman's terms, when you're walking through a neighbourhood, flick on the Wi-Fi on your phone, you can see all the different Wi-Fi networks that are available. And the information that's passing between the devices and the internet, the network, that information can be read in some respects. And that is allegedly what the BBC are going to be doing. But the BBC say, no, that's not the case.
Yeah, they have fully denied this and said that there's been considerable inaccurate reporting about TV license evasion. And their statement says, while we don't discuss the details of how detection works for obvious reasons, it is wrong to suggest that our technology involves capturing data from private Wi-Fi networks.
The Telegraph's article was somewhat lacking in technical detail. Matt, you're a technical man. You've been looking at some of the technical details. So why is this so unlikely? And why are we so sure that the BBC is probably telling the truth?
So there's a lot of reasons behind this. So firstly, if we talk about scale, if you've got a van that's sitting outside somebody's house, the Telegraph said that you will need a directional antenna to be able to look and point at each house or each place. But houses can have multiple Wi-Fi networks. Houses.
People live in flats.
People live in flats. There we go. There's lots of different houses next to each other. So that this is one initial problem that there is. There's also a problem to do with encryption, whether if the data and the packets that are being passed from the Wi-Fi network to your devices are actually encrypted, if they'll be able to be de-encrypted easily and actually be able to be accessible. And also there's lots of other streaming services and catch-up services. So Netflix, ITV, Channel 4, YouTube, the whole internet is about video these days. So if you're transporting packets across from one place to another, they could all look very similar.
And it would be very difficult to spot the BBC in amongst the noise, and not necessarily possible. And there's another thing that's quite important here. This is all about Wi-Fi. Every streaming service that I use is wired. It's over an Ethernet connection. I have a Roku box that's plugged into my TV. So at no point does anything get transmitted wirelessly. So I'd be invisible.
You would. And there would be a way for the BBC to detect that if they wanted to. This is hypothetical. Again, this is not saying that they are doing this, but they could, in theory, use authorization to actually... Well, they could look at the data coming from that's going into your house and going into your TV, and if you compared that to Wi-Fi signals, you could maybe, in theory, produce this. But there's probably not that many people in these TV detection vans. The BBC doesn't really release figures saying this because they don't want to give people an idea of how many people are doing this or not, because then it makes it more likely that you are going to that you may avoid it if you know that there's only four people, for example, hypothetically.
Yeah.
So it's just one of these things where realities of this don't actually really match up with the technical.
Really, really expensive, really technically difficult. And if they wanted to prove that I was watching something over a wire connection, they probably need to use anti-terror legislation, and they'd need to somehow have evidence that I had a wire connection. That it's just impossible. It's a fairly strange story. But the important thing is, if you're in the UK and you currently watch only iPlayer and you don't pay a license fee, you're going to need one from the 1st of September. Otherwise, you're a bad person. You should be paying for the stuff that the BBC makes. That's the important thing here, right? Pay for good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And this is all high-quality content that is being produced by the BBC. I imagine that most people in the UK consume it either actively or passively in some way on a daily basis. So why not pay for it and save them the hassle?
Yeah, and the change to the legislation, just briefly, is because people are watching TV in different ways. Amelia, you said that you watch a lot of TV streamed online.
Yeah.
How much TV do you say, like, to flick on a TV and just flick through the channels? How much of that do you actually do?
Very, very rarely. I have a Netflix subscription. My sister has Amazon Prime. So when we live together, we watch shows basically just on those two platforms, really. It was very rare that we would ever actually put the TV on.
Yeah, and Matt, the same for you?
Sport, mostly sport's the thing that I turn the TV on for, and the BBC at the moment has got all the Olympics, which is going on and is great, and I would pay for that probably twice over.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something like 63 live streams can be going on at the same time for the Olympics, so it's an extraordinary thing to put together. But we're seeing it more and more people are ditching linear television and going for non-linear, or whichever way around it is. Basically, Netflix and chill. Which brings us seamlessly, I didn't even mean to do that, it was brilliant. Last week, Wired's Matt Reynolds met up for Banana Bread and Chit Chat with Netflix founder and CEO Reed Hastings. I kid you not. You can read the interview online, where there's also some video highlights if you don't like pictures that much. But if you don't like pictures or words, we've also got it on the podcast. So here's a brief excerpt. Matt started off by asking when Reed realized that Netflix had become a cultural phenomenon, or as he put it, a really big cultural deal. Let's have a listen.
I think a huge cultural deal, as opposed to just lots of popularity, might be the Netflix and chill meme. when you know, everyone's talking about this thing, and you could look back on Twitter and see like a 5-year history of it slowly growing and then breaking into the mainstream. So that was about a year ago.
Did you get Netflix and chill as soon as you first heard it? You're like, oh yeah, that's what that is.
No, see the gray hair? No, I had someone explain it to me. What?
Yeah. And what does that kind of like tell you about what your platform has done for, you know, how people watch TV and how it's changed?
Well, it tells that people feel warmly about Netflix. So they, you know, use it in a meme about sex. They use it in lots of different ways because it's very comfortable. It's something that they own. It's not something that we created. But what we have to do is just keep producing amazing shows. So if we do Making a Murderer, if we do Stranger Things, we got an amazing one in the UK coming up, The Crown, about Queen Elizabeth in the 1950s, and Winston Churchill, and Peter Morgan's doing it for us. It's unbelievable. So that'll be a big hit in November.
And obviously you do so much around user data and understanding how people watch and what people watch. How much do you feel that you're responding to what people, you know, want, or, you know, what their data suggests they want, and how much do you think you're kind of like pushing it and changing how people watch TV?
We're pushing it and changing it. So the big place the algorithms are is when you come to the service, then we sort and organize the titles by what we think will be most interesting for you, because there's thousands of titles. Mm-hmm. But in terms of picking the content, that's really taste. And it's why we're growing and doing international distribution and production. So we got a show in Germany, a show in Spain, Italy, France, UK. So, you know, we're really trying to lead in that way.
And speaking kind of leading in the future, what about virtual reality? Where does Netflix and virtual reality meet? So I know you did a VR DVD suite, right? You can go in and, you know, pick your, that's kind of like a hack.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Yeah, we're having some fun with VR, but I think that's a gaming format more than it is a movie and TV show format.
Okay, so you don't think that people are going to be strapping on their headsets and stepping into, like, you know, Stephen Avery's world?
Yeah. No, that's kind of overkill. So I don't think, no pun intended. So I think people will watch TV on a TV, and when they do VR, they'll do gaming like, you know, on Xbox.
Based on everything you know about great formulas for TV shows, can you give me a pitch for the perfect TV show? What are the ingredients?
The perfect TV show is something you've never seen before that combines elements that are unique. Nobody really gets that excited about yet another sitcom. What you want to do is find something that's common enough to relate to, but different enough to shock you and think, oh my God, I've never seen anything like this, which is the genius in Making a Murderer, or the genius in Orange is the New Black.
But would you say you've made TV production, or, you know, creative production, into a bit of a science?
Say it again?
Into a bit of a science. You've made the art, you know, the art of making a TV show into a science that you know what works.
No.
Okay.
No, it's art. So it's art. It's art. You know, we work hard on this stuff. You know, there's a little bit of science in the merchandising on the website, those kinds of things. But most of the creative process is creative.
But you know better than, say, when they made The Sopranos, that a show is going to take off.
Not a lot better. Yeah, I know everybody wants to be like, you know, you just, the machine can write the script and do everything, but that's just not the reality. Reality is it's a great creative synthesis. And sure, there, we look at some data, but so does everybody. So, you know, so does the BBC. I mean, so people look at data, but it's still a big creative leap to see something that's fresh, unique, you haven't seen before, and that's well done.
Thanks to Matt and Reed Hastings for that. But Amelia, just before we go for this week, that isn't the only Netflix news around this week. And appropriately, from what Reed was telling Matt, it's all about original shows. Tell us some more.
Yeah, so as you may have guessed, I spend a lot of time watching Netflix, and I really think it's upped its game recently with the new and original content. So some of you may have watched The Fundamentals of Caring, which was broadcast at Sundance earlier this year. And that was a big deal because it was a big original Netflix film, and being broadcast at a place like Sundance is really giving Netflix the credibility of creating these really great films and TV shows.
And it's heading back to a major film festival in Toronto to debut its next big original show.
Yes. So in September, there are going to be four new documentaries at the Toronto Film Festival screened by Netflix, because they're really trying to push the documentary content, and they're wanting to break the boundaries.
So this is after the success of Making a Murderer. They realize that there's somewhere in their data and their creative instinct, they've realized, we should be commissioning more of this stuff. So what's coming up?
So obviously on the true crime theme, there's going to be a big documentary about Amanda Knox and the Meredith Kircher murder and trial that took place from 2007. And it's going to be obviously looking at the very, very gruesome murder that happened to the British student in Italy in 2007. And
they're also hooking up with Oscar winner Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio is on board too, and is executive producing a thriller documentary called The Ivory Game, which is all going to be about the fight to save the African elephant from extinction, which I think will probably be quite gruesome, but probably pretty emotional as well.
And there's more.
Yes, and we're getting back to volcanoes. There's going to be a new documentary called Into the Inferno, which is analysing volcanoes and their relationships with humans. And finally,
that's made by Werner Herzog. So it's kind of appropriate. I can imagine him talking about the death and destruction wrought by volcanoes will sound kind of nice.
And the volcanologist Clive Oppenheimer. And I think a volcanologist is a really cool career path. And then finally, the last documentary is called The White Helmets. And this is following three volunteer rescue workers in Syria and Turkey from earlier this year, trying to save the civilians affected by the war. So that will definitely be emotional and probably really interesting as well.
So despite Netflix having some problems making money and some problems on the stock market with its valuation, they're really, really going big on this original content. It's obviously the main reason that most people subscribe. Yeah. And it means that, as Reed said, that they can get the same thing launched simultaneously in every single country around the world where they're available. So this is going to be at the Toronto International Film Festival, 30th of September, and they'll be available when?
Reed said autumn, so kind of November time, I think he hinted to Matt, so definitely just keep an eye out on your Netflix for some great films.
Netflix and chill, as they say. I didn't have any idea what it meant, so I think it's fine that Reed didn't. Okay, that's it for the podcast this week. We will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.